momentum behind the so-called Green New Deal is growing. Roughly 24 House Democrats support it. The goal is to form a congressional committee to work on legislation that would give us solutions to the climate crisis. We're talking about the Green New Deal and what it is here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hannah Northey is an energy reporter for E&E News, and she's been writing about the Green New Deal. Hannah, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, when I think of Green New Deal, I immediately think of the New Deal, the 1930s, the public works projects, FDR, the Great Depression. Is there anything reminiscent to what happened in the 30s with the New Deal?
I think that's what activists and progressive Democrats are hoping. If this plan is implemented, it would hypothetically constitute one of the largest mobilizations or mass public investments since World War II. And what they're calling for is action of that kind, the same kind of mobilization to really attack the challenge of climate change and revive the economy. But there are definitely critics out there.
So what specific policy changes are these politicians trying to push here?
Mm-hmm. Well, so right now, the Green New Deal, it's like an ambitious framework of policy proposals that Democrats are pushing. And it's also kind of like a rallying cry, a public enthusiasm. It's really an umbrella of policy proposals, and the details haven't been fleshed out. But what we do know is that they're calling for the United States to shift to 100% renewables within a decade. It would decarbonize the entire industry, our nation, and it would create a federal jobs program with a $15 minimum wage and benefits.
So there are things in here that would address climate change. There are things to address poverty. And are those things working in concert with each other, do you see?
I mean, hypothetically, that's what would happen, right? The federal jobs program would be aimed at clean energy or efficiency projects. The goal of 100% renewables would be targeted at the energy industry. The efficiency part, the smart grid portion, all of these proposals are supposed to work together. Now, whether that'll actually happen or not, of course, is unseen.
So who are the key politicians behind the Green New Deal? Who's pushing this?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Representative-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, of course, is the leader. She's pitched this proposal on her website, or just really the bullet points that she wants to see. And then behind her, actually, there are now 35 House Democrats who are supporting this proposal. And so there is a lot of momentum behind this plan, but there are, almost 200 Democrats in the House. So this is still a small but growing but vocal minority. And then behind them are groups like the Sunrise Movement. It's an activist group that, has roots in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and they've been storming the Capitol just yesterday. More than 1,000 activists went to the offices of House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, McGovern, and they're calling for action. So it's both the activists and then this younger generation of progressive Democrats, many of them first-time candidates. And then also there are some established members of Congress, too, like Congressman John Lewis of Georgia, a well-known civil rights activist. And then obviously yesterday, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, including Mark Pocan from Wisconsin, threw their support behind the deal.
So someone wrote that the backers are a slew of enthusiastic young environmentalists. With a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican president, what are the chances of actually pushing something like this through?
Right. So in our coverage, we have talked to the activist leaders of the Sunrise Movement, and they're not expecting change within the next 2 years necessarily. What they're calling for is the formation of this special committee, and the committee would be charged with writing the legislation over the next 2 years, bringing in witnesses, and of course the authority and exactly whether or not that select committee will be set up is still to be determined. But they acknowledge that under the Trump administration or with a Republican Senate, they're not going to see action necessarily on any of these priorities, but they're setting it up to be an issue in the 2020 presidential election.
because it's a real stark contrast to President Trump's environmental policies and his environmental outlook. His administration has not prioritized energy efficiency or combating climate change. And in Poland, they were pushing fossil fuels. It just seems very unlikely that some of these proposals would actually go anywhere under this administration. What's your assessment there?
Well, it's not going to go anywhere. Definitely during the next 2 years, nothing is going to happen. But at the same time, these progressive Democrats are saying, look at how much momentum we have. Look at all these activists that are heading to the Hill. Look at how we are pushing through the creation of a select committee. And so I think, you know, some people have said that it's not so much the policy prescriptions or the lack thereof, but the fact that there's grassroots energy. But yeah, there is no way that these policies are not going to pass during the next 2 years. And then when 2020 comes, we'll see, you know, which of the candidates, the presidential contenders, you know, line up with this plank of thinking, what kind of proposals they're moving toward.
Talking with Hannah Northey, she is an energy reporter for E&E News. We're looking at the so-called Green New Deal and how lawmakers on Capitol Hill are lining up behind it and who's not lining up behind it, how activists are working behind the scenes, including the Sunrise Movement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Green New Deal? Is there something in there that you see as a real aha moment for you? Do you think that the country could get behind it? Do you think lawmakers on Capitol Hill could embrace it? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's break down a little bit, Hannah, the components of this proposal. One of the goals is to shift to 100% renewable energy sources in a decade. Mm-hmm. Is that possible?
It's interesting. I dug into this issue just yesterday, and what I found is that researchers say that pretty much anything is possible with enough money and political will, but there are real engineering questions when you get to these really high levels of renewable penetration, and that's where some of the debate begins, as I found. You know, some will say you only need a smarter grid, more battery storage, and more flexibility in demand to get up to 100% renewables. Others say when you take gas out of the mix, it just, you need to have more technology, one that doesn't exist. They say it just becomes more difficult at those high penetrations. So I think that a lot more research and debate is going on, and also it really does come down to financial and political will.
The plan includes a national jobs program. How would that work?
Another great question. So it's a $15 per hour wage with benefits. And what they're essentially saying is that this would be government funded. It's a green jobs program for anybody that wants one. And so when I asked activists or the leaders of the Sunrise Movement, well, what exactly might that mean? It could be installing solar panels, wind turbines, making buildings more efficient, removing lead from schools. So they have different examples, but it's not totally clear how it would be implemented. Hypothetically, it would come from the federal level, and then these jobs would be created at the local or community level, like where all these people live. Of course, there are critics. Senator John Barrasso, who's the incoming, he's the EPW chair, which some of this legislation would go through. He says this is a crazy mess, right? He's criticizing the Green New Deal, but essentially, I think this is a progressive Democrat's way of saying this is how we would build jobs, this is how we would address climate change, and this is how we would support the economy.
Green New Deal is inspired by FDR's legendary public works programs in the 30s that were meant to lift America out of the Great Depression. The Green New Deal is supposed to reduce climate pollution while lifting struggling families out of poverty. We're learning about it with E&E reporter Hannah Northey. You can join in 800-642-1234. Have you heard of the Green New Deal? What are your thoughts on it? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Green New Deal, looking at whether it will gain traction on Capitol Hill, looking at whether the plan would go anywhere, what barriers it might face under the current administration. talking about it on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hannah Northey stays with us. She's a reporter for E&E News. You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. What stands out to you about this Green New Deal? Is this something that you want Congress to take up? Is it possible to support renewable energy without compromising America's manufacturing industries? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Nancy now in Wausau. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I feel the new Green Deal could be a big possibility. I know here in Wisconsin, we have Mandela Barnes and Tony Evers really toting it. And I think it is something that Congress needs to take up. I think the GOP, however, is really holding us back due to the fact that they are bought and paid for, beholden to big oil.
Nancy, thanks for the call. She made the point that we in Wisconsin have a new incoming Democratic governor. She also made the point that lawmakers are tied to the oil industry, and there's a lot of lobbying that goes on. Hannah?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. And many of these progressive Democrats that want a special committee formed, they have been signing pledges to accept no fossil fuel money. So I think that they do acknowledge that that is a point. Some of that funding is a bit of a point of conflict with some of these established veteran Democrats who want the committees to work in such a way they're pushing back on the creation of a special new committee. But also, yes, Republicans are both undercutting the science of climate science when it comes to these hearings, and we don't know if they're not making it a priority, so I think you are going to see more public enthusiasm behind the Green New Deal.
Has there been a response from manufacturing, other industries, how this Green New Deal would work?
Not yet. It's pretty early, but as we can see through some of the Republicans like Barrasso, he circulated a memo yesterday calling it a crazy expensive mess. I mean, you can see the message trying to undercut the plan or undercut some of this enthusiasm. So I think you may see more of that, but at the same time, I mean, some of these industries are already embracing efficiency measures, just like the energy sector is. So there is some of this work underway.
Is there a way to implement a carbon tax without harming business interests? Can you walk that line?
I think that's a great question. And some of the Republicans in Congress who are concerned about climate change and accept the science have pushed for a carbon tax. But progressive Democrats for a Green New Deal say that that's been too politically tricky, that it can be a part of this larger framework, but it can't be the only sticking point. So that's an interesting debate.
One of the other things in this Green New Deal is a smart grid. What is a smart grid?
So it's a term of art in the industry. It can mean many different things, but really it has to do with more sensors on the grid. It has to do with moving away from a system that's designed around big centralized power plants and one-way power flows. And so I think the idea, again, like that work is already underway. A lot of, you know, millions of dollars have been invested in smart meters and storage. But I think the idea of what the Green New Deal is trying to get at is that they want a smarter, more sensitive, more flexible grid to support renewables. And possibly, I mean, when you think about a green grid, you have to move power from wind and solar hubs to other places that need it across the country.
So how does the proposal then expand on energy efficiency? Where do you see those high points in this plan?
Right. Well, again, the details are not there yet, so it's kind of hard to say. But what we do know is that the Trump administration has slowed down or just stopped efficiency measures coming out of the Department of Energy. And so even to have a focus on that would advance the issue. And this is something that Nancy Pelosi has actually given voice to. She said, I want to create this special committee because it would address efficiency. And so you can save a lot. I mean, there are different appliances. There's a different suite of technologies, but these measures have been slowed. So this would change that.
Hannah Northey is with us as we talk about the Green New Deal. She's reports with E&E News. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you pay attention to environmental goals of your lawmakers? Does the environment drive your vote? Is it possible to support renewable energy without hurting America's manufacturing. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Hannah, you briefly touched on the Sunrise Movement as having some propelling this Green New Deal forward. What do we know about the activism behind the Green New Deal?
Well, some of my colleagues have written quite a bit about the Sunrise Movement, but essentially it has its roots in the Occupy Wall Street movement. It has support from the Sierra Club, and a lot of these activists actually had contact with Ocasio-Cortez before she ran for office. And so it's been a larger movement that's grown. And since then, they have moved into the Capitol or really demonstrated on pivotal days. Ocasio-Cortez's first day in office, they were camped out at Pelosi's office calling for a select committee, and Ocasio-Cortez made an appearance. So they have actually been really politically savvy.
So very visible as well. Is that going to make an impact here? Will activism play a larger role in the Green New Deal and what it intends to do?
I really do think so, especially in the last couple months, we've had 5 dire climate reports come out, and that's what these activists say are fueling them. It's the threat of climate change, the need to act fast, and I don't think that that's going to go away. The Sunrise Movement is really a millennial-led grassroots movement, and so they're pushing and pushing for action. And I mean, you can kind of see during the midterms that really surfaced, and so I don't think that that's going to go away. And I think Democrats want to tap into that, too.
So the Green New Deal has a catchy slogan. It captures progressive policies. It has broad policy proposals right now, not really very specific ways on implementing. It has some ideas about process and the committee work. Does it have anything else besides that? When will we know whether this takes off?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think we're going to watch to see if the select committee is formed. We're going to see who they bring in and, you know, who are the witnesses, what kind of fact-finding missions do they go on, and then we're going to see who comes forward with, like, actual language, right? So Bernie Sanders has said he wants to come out with legislation that kind of mirrors the Green Deal pitch. When I talk to Sunrise activists, they talk about all these different bills that they could pull from that are potential sources of legislative language. And so I think the ideas are marinating, but we're going to have to wait to see what actually comes out of it.
Do we know anything more about how this sits with Nancy Pelosi?
We don't. I mean, she has said that she supports reviving the special committee, and she actually did run a special committee of this kind in the past, which fizzled when Republicans took the House back, but that came up with the Waxman-Markey climate cap-and-trade bill. What's kind of interesting is that there's tweaking going on. You know, how this moves through existing committees, does it respect the existing turf of veteran Democrats? I think all of that's, it's just so quickly changing. Mm. You could potentially see more support shaping up for it.
Let's go to John joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello. We do need a large political shift to change our direction. This is a serious problem. It's worldwide. It's not just here. Excuses like India or China not doing enough are not sufficient to me.
So, John, do you think you will see a huge political shift? We're short on time. What's going to be the impetus?
The people, I hope. It's got to be a push through the heart of the people to get this done.
Well, John, thanks for the call. Hannah, as we start to wrap up here, what are you watching next for the Green New Deal? Where are your eyes?
I think we are going to watch what the House rules are to see if the select committee is formed. I think at the beginning of January, that decision will be made, and then we're going to see who it's staffed with. If it's not created, how would these ideas be taken up and moved forward? Frank Pallone, the incoming head of the Energy and Commerce Committee, has said he's going to hold a series of hearings on climate change, and then, of course, what comes in 2020, right, with the next presidential contenders.
And we'll be watching for that. Thank you so much for joining us, Hannah.
Thanks
appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
Yeah, Hannah Northey is an energy reporter for E&E News, and she's been writing about the Green New Deal. Up next is the news, and we'll talk to a reporter about what's happening to Wisconsin's juvenile justice system in preparation for the closure of Lincoln Hills. And thank you to all who contributed during our year-end membership drive. You donated more than $375,000. $2,350 listeners pledged, and we're glad to welcome 425 new members to the WPR family. Lots of numbers there. And if you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your donation at WPR.org. Your year-end gift ensures a strong future for the Wisconsin Public Radio programs that you love in 2019 and beyond. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Under current law, counties building new youth corrections facilities will need to be finished with construction by January 1st, 2021. This comes after the legislature voted in March to close the troubled Lincoln Hill School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls in Irma. Wisconsin's Corrections Department will provide counties almost all of the funding, but will that be enough? And what is Wisconsin's vision here for a new and improved youth prison system? Questions we're asking on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Riley Vetterkind has been reporting on this as government and political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. His piece is titled, Wisconsin Counties Cautious as They Consider Building Youth Detention Center. Riley, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, bring us up to speed on where Lincoln Hills is in its evolution, because state lawmakers passed legislation in March to shut down the juvenile detention center. What does this timeline look in closing Lincoln Hills and building new facilities?
So the legislative remedy to closing Lincoln Hills and dealing with the slew of problems there began in January of this year when Governor Walker announced that he would be closing down the youth prison located in northern Wisconsin near Irma. After he made the announcement, it was up to lawmakers to craft the bill. This was quite a process. Lawmakers got to drafting. They went through several versions of something that they could agree upon. Late in the legislative session, it actually appeared as if the bill was going to die. Lawmakers just couldn't agree on a solution. But at the very last minute, and this was toward, I believe, the end of March, lawmakers finally came together, passed a bill that they could all agree upon, and the governor signed it into law on March 30th of this year. After that, a committee was set up, a juvenile justice committee, that is exploring how to break apart what's currently basically one system. It's called a Type 1 facility, which is what Lincoln Hills is, where currently I think a little bit more than 100 offenders are located there. Under the bill, what is going to happen is it's going to divide what was this one Type 1 facility into Type 1 and into what's called these SRCCCYs. Now, it's a really long name, and basically what SRCCCYs are is just places for less serious youth offenders. So under the bill, what's going to happen is the most serious offenders at Lincoln Hills are going to be housed in a another Type 1 facility with updated requirements. That facility is likely to be located in Milwaukee County. That's because most of the most serious offenders currently housed at Lincoln Hills are from Milwaukee County, the most populous county in the state. And then the less serious offenders largely will be held in about five or six, and that number is still yet to be determined, of these county-run centers, which counties will receive funding from the state to build. Those will be scattered across the state. Several counties are considering building them. However, the state is not requiring that counties build them.
So these five or six centers that will be built around the state are for lower level offenders, and they're much smaller. Is that right?
They'll be much smaller. One of the largest of them will be in Milwaukee County, but here in Dane County, for instance, the center that they're considering is expected to only house about 14 males and six females, and that would be located at the city county building here in Madison.
And so do we know what counties are eyeing this? Do we know what counties these other smaller centers will be located in?
So talks are very much still underway. I spoke to a lobbyist from the Wisconsin Counties Association, and that association has been really good about bringing all the counties interested in building one of these centers together. Those counties are typically the ones who currently have offenders housed at Lincoln Hills. Some of those include, the counties you'd expect, like Dane, Milwaukee, Racine, with the highest populations of youth offenders and the highest populations overall. Some smaller counties considering building facilities are Rock, Portage has been thrown out there, Brown County, Eau Claire, La Crosse. Eau Claire is no longer considering the option. I was told by the Health and Human Services director there that since they already have such a low number of serious offenders, it's more in their interest to focus their efforts on just looking at the preventative side and trying to prevent youth from ending up in a detention facility at all. And so they decided on early in the process to drop their bid.
Why would a county want to build a youth complex, a residential facility like this?
So from the counties I talked to, they're really, really interested in getting all of their offenders out of Lincoln Hills, which is still under federal investigation for the abuses that occurred there beginning, I think since 2010 it's been. And so, they appear to really care about trying to make conditions better for the offenders, get them closer to home. Right now, if an offender is from the Milwaukee County area, where they're currently housed is, probably a 4-hour drive away.
Right.
Part of the solution lawmakers had in mind was locating the facilities closer to home so that and allowing more visitation hours for families to help the youth offenders through the process.
Riley Vedderkind is a government and politics reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. We're talking about the status of counties building smaller youth detention facilities as Lincoln Hills prepares to close. Gathering your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. How do you think the new juvenile detention centers should be run? How should Wisconsin approach building these facilities around the state? And do you live in one of the counties that are proposing to build a center, a juvenile detention center? What are your thoughts? Is your county currently considering one? Let's hear from you at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Help us understand where the money is going to come from for these counties. Is it a grant program they apply for to build these centers?
Yep. So legislators in the Lincoln Hills bill that was passed earlier this year set aside $40 million for a grant program to be distributed to the counties that are eventually chosen by a juvenile justice committee. The official decision on who will get the money will be made by this committee and then will need to be passed through the state's budget writing committee in midsummer. After that, counties can hire architects. They can continue to plan for their facilities, and then they can do bidding, go through the construction process, and hopefully build their facilities by the end of 2020. Now, some counties, I should back up a little bit. An interesting figure, and I just confirmed this with the lawmaker last night, is that 95% of this grant funding or I should say, for male facilities, the state is providing 95% of the grant funding, and for female facilities, it's providing 100% of the grant funding. That was done because costs for female facilities tend to be a bit higher because there tend to be more mental health needs among that population, is what I've been told by the lawmaker who crafted this bill, or was who had a part in crafting the bill, Evan Goyke. And what lawmakers feared, he said, was that because the female population is already so low, some counties just might completely pass up building one, since it really wouldn't be in their interest, since some might, you know, have such a low population of female offenders.
How much might it cost to build a facility like this?
So from the people I talked to, it's really, really hard to get an exact estimate. But for comparison, the state set aside $25 million for its new Type 1 facility, which is likely going to be located in the Milwaukee area. That's just going to be most in almost any circumstance, that would be just one facility. I talked to Milwaukee County, which is considering both a new facility and a renovated facility, and they don't expect that $40 million is going to be enough to build their own facility. You know, they're hoping it will, but, you know, it's kind of all bets are off there.
I mean, it's a risk because you can underestimate how much this project will really cost. And then is the county footing that bill?
A lot of the costs need to be, and how the state will pay is another concern from counties. From the directors I talked to, there isn't a real guarantee at this point whether the money will come immediately via the grant or whether it will be distributed later and they'll be reimbursed. That's kind of still an open question for some counties, and that's another reason that they've been a bit cautious about considering this. I should say that the counties I've talked to have also been very happy with the state in the way that the state has worked with them so far. The state and lawmakers have been really flexible, they've said, in considering their needs, because both parties really do want to see this prison closed down in Lincoln
so
Hills.
When these smaller facilities are built around the state and the money is there for that, for building, what about operational costs? Who foots the bill there?
So for counties who decide to build one of these regional centers, the county will receive a 15% bump in what's called youth aids payments, which they already receive from the state, partially to take care of their youth offenders. That funding will increase. However, some counties are still concerned, you know, the operational funding might not be enough. That's another part of the bill that the Wisconsin Counties Association and some of the counties involved are hoping to potentially up.
We're looking at the state's new idea for a youth prison complex, smaller facilities around the state. Riley Vedderkin stays with us. He's been reporting on this. You can join in, 800-642-1234. How do you think the new juvenile detention center should be run? What should be different compared to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake? We'll continue to talk about the future of youth detention facilities here in Wisconsin in just a moment on the Ideas Network. One of the big goals in building these smaller youth facilities around Wisconsin is to get juvenile offenders closer to their families. Lincoln Hills is more than 3 hours away from southeastern Wisconsin, where 80% of inmates live. We're talking about how cities around the state will go about building these regional facilities and what that funding situation will look like and what these facilities will be like. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you can join in with your thoughts on Wisconsin's prison system revamp for juveniles, 800-642-1234. Have you made visits to Lincoln Hills in the past? What is your reaction to its closure, and how can Wisconsin make improvements to the youth prison system? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Government and politics reporter Riley Vedderkin stays with us. He's been covering this at the Wisconsin State Journal. Riley, Governor-elect Tony Evers has acknowledged that the funding and the timelines could present problems, but Evers has been on this committee. What do we know about what the governor-elect is thinking about the detention centers and the way we have set up youth detention here in Wisconsin?
So Governor-elect Evers on the campaign trail has been concerned about the situation at Lincoln Hills, although it was never a focus of his campaign. He was recently asked in Milwaukee whether he would be interested in upping the funding or extending the timeline. He said he would be open to looking at that. A lot still needs to be determined because he will be able to appoint new members to the committee, is my understanding, because a lot of them are currently, like one member, for instance, is the DOC secretary. That is likely to change, although that's not written in stone. And so the committee will change, and the department is likely going to, the committee is likely to be waiting until after the new administration takes office to make decisions over how to handle the funding and the timelines. Mm-hmm. Lawmakers need to get together, stakeholders need to get together that were in on the bill. And so a lot is to be determined still. It's likely that this could be pushed off for quite some time. When it comes to operational funding, for instance, that might not need to be dealt with until the next budget, the 2021-23 budget, instead of the one that we're
currently in.
Yep.
Well, Lincoln Hills has struggled. You had mentioned, of course, federal and state investigations. Federal investigations still ongoing. Are regional centers the fix here? How can we make sure that we're not repeating past mistakes with Lincoln Hills? And are there ways that you're seeing in your reporting that these regional centers are going to be different?
So what's currently happening is the Department of Corrections is drafting new rules for these centers, the SRCCCYs or regional centers that have never existed before. Those rules, I'm told, are supposed to be allowing for things like more outdoor space for offenders, allow more visitation time, allow more instruction. They're supposed to be kind of stopping or at least depressing the practice of solitary confinement, a lot of the problems that occurred at Lincoln Hills. These rules are supposed to be submitted to the governor by the end of the month, and then he's supposed to sign off on them. I believe that's still the case. And so there is currently a draft of a lot of these rules right now. Counties are largely satisfied with them. They are looking for a couple tweaks. Go ahead.
Will counties have any latitude in their facilities in how they design them, or will they be very much a recipe coming from the corrections department?
So corrections has almost exclusively taken this up as their own project. However, they have given the rules to the counties to look at beforehand so that they could make any last-minute changes before they're officially submitted to the governor.
Let's go to Adam joining us from Seymour. Hi, Adam.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
So I think some of the reasons that Lincoln Hills has failed is because of its location and because of Governor Walker's war on state employees. I think it's going to be really hard for the state to supply a place like Lincoln Hills with quality corrections officers when corrections officers' pay is continually lowered, and it's in the middle of nowhere. And I think that's something that the counties need to consider when they make these facilities. If you put these facilities in the middle of nowhere, who are you going to have staff them?
That's a really good point. In Brown County, for instance, they are really cautious about considering a facility at all because they're really doubtful that they will be able to both recruit and maintain their members. It's no secret that, or I shouldn't say members, their staff.
Their staff.
It's no secret that the Department of Corrections has continuously battled with really bad turnover rates. This is even more difficult in an economy where unemployment is at 3%. Representative Michael Schraw told me that, people just aren't looking to work in corrections when they could go get a job elsewhere.
Yeah, these are difficult jobs. Do we know how many jobs these regional facilities would create?
That I don't know. That's something that I think I'd like to explore in further reporting. But since it's still to be determined how many centers we'll have, as well as how much funding will be allowed for these positions, that's something that I can't answer at this point.
Would these centers have more... more corrections officers per inmate, for instance? Would there be better ratios than at Lincoln Hills?
That is something, again, that needs to be decided in the official rules that DOC comes out with. Once those are signed off on, I'll have a better answer there.
Yeah, but these smaller facilities closer to a juvenile's home, that in itself should get us pretty far here in creating this overhaul. Proximity matters that much?
That's what experts say. The proximity does matter, having families close, not having them housed so far away. But one thing I should say is a lot of the counties and a lot of the lawmakers behind this bill realize that this is not a complete solution to the Lincoln Hills problem. A lot of people point to the fact that offenders really should be prevented from going to these centers at all. In Eau Claire County, which I said before is no longer considering a county facility, they're really, really interested in looking at preventative measures, at community-based solutions that really try to stop this problem at the front end.
Help us understand the next set of dates in the timeline as this unfolds, as we get closer to January 1st, 2021.
Mm-hmm. So March 31st is the deadline for counties to submit their design proposals. These design proposals, from the architects I've talked to and from the counties I've talked to, are most likely to be early drafts. They're not supposed to be really comprehensive sketches or designs. After that, the juvenile committee will get together and look at all the proposals that came in and decide where these facilities should be located and which counties should take the projects on. Because what's likely to happen, or what will happen, I should say, is the counties who build these facilities most likely will be housing offenders from neighboring counties.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the smaller counties that only have, a handful of offenders, it doesn't make sense for them to build a facility at all. And so the juvenile committee will decide in the spring and the summer which counties it thinks it makes most sense to build facilities, and then the Joint Finance Committee will sign off on their recommendation in midsummer during the budget process.
Do you think this will be competitive among counties?
Competitive? I'm not so sure if I'd use that word.
Yeah.
I think that the main counties are Milwaukee and mm-hmm. Racine and Dane that have the largest facilities that, feel obliged to build. But it's not going, I don't think anyone's viewing this as a great boon for the county. They're doing it because they need to take their offenders out of Lincoln Hills.
Well, Riley, thank you so much for coming by. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Riley Vedderkind is a government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Next up, a recent report details how the projected impacts of climate change will affect the nation's economy, infrastructure, and environment. We'll discuss what those impacts will look like in the Midwest and on transportation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.